Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. I've always had a big respect for wildlife filmmakers. Not only is it a job that requires a huge level of patience, but it's a job that results in bringing nature and sights from the natural world into the homes of millions of people. Scenes that are the reasons why I, and many of you, love nature today. And because of this, I was very excited about today's show with marine biologist and marine wildlife filmmaker and photographer, Inca Cresswell. From the beauty, the prep, and the challenges, Inca gave a brilliant insight into the world of underwater filmmaking. We spoke about her short film, My 25, and its focuses of listening to the previous generation regarding their stories of the natural world in order to fully understand how our environments have changed. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi Inca, thank you very much for joining me on today's episode of Into the Wild. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. Have you had a good day in the sun or out of the sun?
Unfortunately, I have been out of the sun today, but I've been diving through archive of lots of beautiful underwater footage, so not too bad. I almost feel like I was able to escape.
That's the best thing. If your job is looking at footage like that, then that's kind of almost the best next thing.
Exactly. Definitely makes me miss the ocean, though.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Well, I'm really excited to talk to you today, but before we get started, for my listeners, can you please just tell us who you are and what is it you do?
Of course. I am Inca Cresswell. I have a background in marine biology and I work in the wildlife filmmaking industry as a photographer, but also doing bits of underwater camera work and as a researcher on bigger projects as well.
Amazing. I ask this question to all my guests because it's always interesting to find out about kind of, you know, where people's love for nature and wildlife comes from. But how did yours develop? Was that something you've always had with you?
I was one of those really weird kids that knew what they wanted to do from a ridiculously young age.
Really?
I think from probably about 3 or 4, I was told by dad that I wanted to be a dolphin trainer. And he very skillfully told me that the real name for that was a marine biologist. And I just completely believed him.
That is the most genius parenting I've ever heard.
Yeah. So I was the little kid that would run around when everyone asked what you want to be when you grow up. I'd go, I want to be a marine biologist, because that's how I thought I would get to play with the dolphins. And I think I just completely convinced myself that that was exactly what I wanted to do, and just became addicted to books and ID guides and IDing random things that I'd find on my local beach. And yeah, it was a passion that started at a young age and just developed into this huge thing.
That's amazing though, because some parents wouldn't have done that. If I'd said to my parents I wanted to be a dolphin trainer, they would have gone, brilliant, that's called a doctor, so if you can go forward with that career. That's brilliant. Credit to your dad there.
Yeah, I think he secretly always wanted to be a marine biologist, so it was definitely a little bit of him living it out through me.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And the filmmaking, did that kind of come later on when you got more into nature? Was it like, were you interested in like studying it, and then like the filming aspect came in a little bit later?
It was a little bit of a mix. I think I started with obviously just a love of the subject, and just that kind of thirst to want to understand it and develop my knowledge of that ecosystem. Mm. But I also love photography, and I've always been a very creative person. And because my dad was quite an avid photographer, he got me into photography quite young. So pretty much from when I started scuba diving at about 11, I also started underwater photography.
Oh, wow.
And it became this way that I think when you're as obsessed as the ocean as I am and you talk people's ears off, people tend to switch off, but if you can show them fantastic imagery as well,
yeah,
you can completely capture their heart and their mind. And I just realized that it was such a fantastic tool to really bring people into my world. And as I grew up and as I learned more and more about these subjects, the more I realized that actually my camera was the best tool that I had for educating others and to share that passion and interest.
Yeah, especially with the marine world as well, because it is an environment that not everyone gets to see. So I guess for you to be able to show people that rather than, like you said, just telling, that's a much bigger step than most people ever really get to have, I guess.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things about the ocean that I love so much, is that you look at it and it's just completely hidden. Mm. It's got so much of the sense of mystery and kind of, you never know what's just below the surface. And I think that was something that I've always found so captivating about our oceans. But with that camera, you can bring people into that privileged space where they can see what is below the waves. And I think it's just, it feels like bringing someone into another world. And that's something that I love doing.
Absolutely. And like, let's go on to wildlife filmmaking, because this is something you're very much known for and skilled at. So, and with something we're going to be focusing on today. So, I think it's evident to everyone that wildlife filmmaking is a very challenging job and requires an incredible amount of patience. But this must be so much more when you're under the water, right?
It is. It's a funny one. I think like any environment, once you know it, those challenges start to slip away. So I always say to anyone who wants to get into photography or to get into underwater filmmaking, the first thing you need is you need scuba diving or free diving to feel like second nature.
Yeah.
So that it's not even something that crosses your mind. And then also having that understanding of the ecosystem that you're working in, understanding the way that the currents move, the way the upwelling sites work, the way that different species interact. Once you kind of learn those aspects of that environment, everything else just starts to fall into place. And I think once you really, that was one of my favorite things when I did my dive master training, was that moment when I realized that I really knew a reef.
Yeah.
And I knew it just as well as I would know a city. I would know which currents to ride to which part, where to find certain species, who would be hanging out with who. And I think when you get to that point of really knowing an environment, it does, like, it, the challenges really do fall away, and you start to just unlock this magical world that's really exciting.
I never really considered currents and all that to be part of, this is how, you know, not at home in the water Ryan is, but I didn't really ever think of that. Is that something you really have to take into consideration for a safety, and I guess also knowing the environment is where the water's going to take you?
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those, like I always say to people, that one of the questions I get asked a lot is, what is my greatest fear in the ocean? And I expect it to be a shark or some kind of venomous sea snake. But the reality is it's the water itself. And
yeah.
Currents can be so, so strong. And even when you know a site back to front, at times you can be caught out because the ocean is unpredictable, and you have to have respect for it in that sense as well. And the currents, as much as they can be something that is really dangerous if you don't navigate them well, they can also be an amazing asset.
Yeah.
And I think that when you're filming, if you know where a current goes and the movement that it takes, it's like having, you're able to glide over an ecosystem in a way that would need full rigging on land.
Yeah, that's so true, yeah.
So you can really use it to your advantage.
And how long, like you were saying about the scuba diving at the beginning and stuff, and getting used to that kind of skill set to have in the water, and also getting used to the currents. Is that a long process, or does that kind of come with any other environment really? It just takes as long as it takes you to do it, or is it a real kind of, you know, it could take you 6 months to 2 years to 5 years?
It's one of those things that really varies from person to person. And I think, like, from my time working just as a dive instructor, there are some people who I would teach and instantly they've picked it up and they're good to go. And then you get other people who are just so nervous, and a lot of it is getting past that fear themselves. And it's funny, actually, I find that the kids that I teach normally pick it up so much quicker.
Yeah.
And I think it's because they don't have the fear and they're not holding themselves back in that way.
Yeah.
And often it's the adults who are overly confident that end up being the worst divers because they don't listen to any of the points or tips and things. So it really depends a lot on your mental attitude going into things and your willingness to learn and to take advice. But like anything, the more you practice it, the better you will be.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was taught kind of when I first started diving, when I first started doing underwater photography, was I was never allowed to take my camera with me on the first dive. And that was partly so that I was more aware of my surroundings. I was familiar with my equipment. I was familiar with the ocean conditions. And just to make sure I kind of got my head around the environment before I added a distraction.
Yes.
And I think when I was starting out, that was such a good tip for anyone who is at the very early stages starting out and still quite new to scuba, is make sure you've mastered your equipment and you're 100% comfortable before adding a distraction such as a camera. And then eventually you get to a point where, obviously, I don't do that anymore, but there were years that I did that, and I highly recommend it.
And what kind of, you were talking about the currents and you being something that you need to have that awareness of, and that can be a big challenge, but what kind of other challenges in regards to, like when we look at wildlife filmmaking, when actually capturing the moments, what challenges do you have when you're underwater that you wouldn't maybe have on land?
There's a mix of different things that you approach, I mean, obviously one of them is that you can't use a telephoto lens with wildlife underwater in the same way you could on land. Mm. So one of the huge advantages you have as a wildlife filmmaker on land is that you could be a decent distance away from your subject and then just zoom all the way in with a fantastic lens and get some beautiful portrait photos and video. But underwater, the visibility stops you from being able to do that. So you have to be able to get close to your subject. Mm. And that in itself is difficult because these are wild animals that you are interacting with. And I've learned that it comes by not only understanding your species, but having a lot of respect for your species.
Yeah.
If you chase a subject, you're never going to get that close-up face-to-face portrait, that close-up of the eye that you're hoping for. You have to understand the species and treat it with respect. And usually that natural curiosity will bring them in. But it's also making sure that you're respectful of the environment you're working in as well, that you're not damaging coral or any other substrates while you're trying to work. I think it's not like on land where you can get a steady footing and just stand up and go. Mm. Underwater, you're constantly having to monitor your buoyancy and be careful of this ecosystem surrounding you and make sure that you're not damaging what you're trying to protect and what you're trying to film. And then, of course, as well, you've got the limited time. You can't sit out in a hide for 4 hours waiting for something to come in. You're running on a limited air supply, and you've got to make sure that you make the most out of that time you have in that world.
So when you're planning a film or a dive, what kind of things do you have to take in consideration, especially when you said just then you've got the limited time? What kind of things do you have to think before you go under?
The things, like when I was working on my student film, what I did is I would set up a shot list, and I would put it in priority of what my must-have shots are. Mm. What my it would be nice to have shots are, and my absolute luxuries if I have extra time, which is very, very rare.
Yeah.
And I think kind of structuring it that way and making sure that you're really clear with yourself about these are the things that I need to tell the story that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Entering the dive with that perspective and having that clear roadmap is really helpful. Obviously, at times the conditions don't work with you, the species don't work with you, and you have to go with the flow, but it's always worth it in the end.
So you said about going closer to the animals being underwater, because obviously, like you said, you've got different equipment and the quality is obviously more challenging underwater. So have you got some big memorable experiences whilst filming that you've had with that kind of thing?
There's been many times where I have not realised there is a great white right next to me.
What?
I have always done cage diving. I would love to be out of the cage at some point, but of course I would only do that with the utmost respect to the species and with the knowledge and the training that I think is required to be that close to an apex predator such as a great white.
Mm.
But I've always been fascinated by how they can move through the water without what seems to be disturbing anything around them.
Yeah.
And because there's that lack of sound underwater, or the muting of sound, you often don't feel that something approaching of that size. And there are moments where you'll turn around and you're literally eye to eye with a huge shark. Oh. Or you can be focused on a bit of like an anemone with some clownfish, and you look up and there's a whale shark above your head. And you've had no cue that something that big has suddenly come in. And that's always takes my breath away a little bit.
Inca, this is why I'm so nervous of the ocean, and in a respect, I know there's not, like, I have the respect for it, and I know I love sharks, I absolutely love them, and it upsets me almost that I have that bit of a fear from, but that's why when people are like, you don't need to fear them, but they're so quiet, but big.
they definitely, it can definitely sneak up on you. I'm always, like, I think it's not about fearing it. I think it's about trying. I understand that people obviously fear these big species at times, but I think it's about just transferring that fear into respect.
Mm.
And I think for me, when I see a massive species like a great white and it's right at my eye level, I have so much respect for them as a species that, there is a little bit of fear, but that's okay. It's a fear that is because I understand what an incredible predator the species is.
Yeah.
And as much as there is that fear present, I'm also able to appreciate the incredible beauty of these species. And that's what I try and capture.
Because it's something I've always wanted to do, always wanted to cage dive with any shark, just to experience it. Because it's not a fear that would stop me doing it. It's just, I guess it's that fear of the unknown as well. It's just, I'm used to, you know, watching it on TV and media rather than experiencing it. So I really want to try it. I've done episodes about sharks. Our one this week was about them, and I love and respect them. But it's just that when people explain that to me and go, oh, they can just sneak up on you. And I'm like, that's not okay.
Yeah, it's funny though. I think every time that I've been out on a great white shark diving expedition, there's been people on the boat who are scared of them and who are a little bit terrified. But every single time on the way back, their entire perspective has shifted.
Yeah.
And I watch people crowded around the computer and looking at photos through the dive, and there's never anyone who's just like, oh, that's terrifying, why would you do that? By the end of those dives and after looking at those images, they're just left going, wow, that is a beautiful species. God, I was so lucky to have been able to witness that. And I think that getting past that fear and just being able to witness those moments, you will absolutely get over it.
Yeah, which is, it's just a wonderful, like you said, a wonderful experience. For an animal to be able to change someone like that, that's when you know it's an incredible thing. Do you have a favourite place you love to dive?
Oh, that's a really hard one. I've done some fantastic dives over the years. I've been very, very lucky. And one of my favourite places to dive is the Socorro Islands. I had the amazing privilege to work with the Waterman Project out there on a shark tagging expedition. And it is a seamount in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's like a 2 days journey from any kind of town or city. And it is the most outstandingly, ruggedly beautiful place I've ever dived.
Wow.
It's volcanic origins, and you go down onto the seamounts, and there's just bottlenose dolphins surrounding you. There's sharks schooling, oceanic manta rays just hanging in the upwellings. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
And do you have a favourite species you like to film? We were talking about sharks then, but is there another species that you absolutely... And this is probably the hardest question, I'm aware of that.
It is a hard one. I absolutely love sharks. I think the great whites are one of my favourites, just because they come with so many preconceptions, and I love creatively being able to try and kind of flip those on their head. And I think it's one of those species that really challenges you to do that and makes me think a lot about perspective and lighting and how I can make something that's been so heavily demonised into something that is beautiful and show a different side to them. So they're always a really joy to work with from that perspective. But I would love to dive with a whale or something ridiculously big like that. I think I would, I'd lose my mind.
Is that on your, I'm going to say, to-do list?
Yes, it's on my to-do list.
I want to talk about your short film that you made called My 25. Can you tell us a bit about what that film was?
Yeah, so basically I did a master's in wildlife filmmaking at the University of the West of England, which is a really fantastic course for anyone who wants to break into the wildlife filmmaking industry, because it gives you this amazing behind-the-scenes kind of insight into this industry and some fantastic guidance on what goes into making a film and producing a film. And this was the film that I produced as my final project for my master's. And it was basically a film that was looking at this idea of shifting baselines, which, to put really simply, is looking at the health of our oceans between different generations and how they've changed. So, for example, if my dad tells me about a reef that he went diving on back when he was my age, and he might go, oh, there was 40 sharks, that's a really healthy reef. I might go diving on that same reef today, and because our standards have shifted so drastically, I could see 10 sharks on that same reef, and I would come up and I would go, wow, that was beautiful. That was a really healthy reef.
Wow.
And in reality, you've just lost a huge number of sharks, but you don't even register how much of a change it is because you're so distanced from the generation before you. Other example that we hear about all the time with that is you have a grandfather who would walk in and go, oh, when I was a boy, I used to catch a fish this big. And we all roll our eyes. But actually, when you look at some of the data, the size of fish have declined so drastically due to overfishing. And in reality, our oceans used to be filled with that many fish at that kind of size. We just can't comprehend it anymore.
Do you think one of the main, and obviously aside from the reasons why, but do you think one of the other issues with that, like you said, is the lack of communication and communicating with the generation prior to know what was there before?
Absolutely, and that was one of the things that I tried to do in the film a little bit. So I realised that kind of generations and kind of the stories that our parents tell us and the stories that we tell our children is something that we do globally, and it's something that we can all relate to. We all have experiences we hope to pass down to the next generation, and I just thought that was a really good way of illustrating these changes in global ocean health. but I also wanted to look at it from the perspective of different people around the world and different people's memories. And from talking to some of the fishermen in the remote Pacific Islands and just hearing from them how they used to be able to dive on the reefs right outside their house, and now they have to spend 3 hours walking up and down the coastline looking for little pockets. And fishermen in Jamaica who used to be able to go out fishing for an hour and come back with enough fish to for their day's catch, and now are having to spend overnights out far at sea, potentially being lost at sea as well. And you just, it's this global issue, and I think we're all experiencing it.
So you mentioned some really good examples there of you know, the not just the challenges that people are facing, but the actual changes that we're seeing in the ocean. What other kind of things are we seeing change globally in our oceans, aside from obviously, like, you know, populations of animals?
I think one of the things that that really interested me in the when I was working in Jamaica was the shift in the stages of the reefs. So you think of a coral reef as this beautiful, vibrant ecosystem, but in reality, in a lot of the Caribbean, we're actually seeing them shift into more of an algal phase. So these beautiful reefs that we know are actually just dominated by algae, and they're really green. As well as that, there's so many dives that I've done in Indonesia where there should be beautiful coral, and instead it's just rubble from dynamite fishing. Or you go on a deep site that's really current-driven, and the amount of fishing line that's just wrapped around the corals. So there's all different things that we can see changing in our oceans. Of course, also ocean acidification, impacts of global warming. So there's a lot of different pressures that I feel are facing our oceans today.
Yeah, and I guess really when we start to look at that, it's I always, when we go onto this kind of topic and we're thinking about, I don't want to use the word issues all the time, but the challenges that the planet faces, what we're putting on it, I just sit here and go, how is this planet still here? Like, I do wonder how it's still working in some way. Yeah. But we hear the issues such as fishing practices or ocean waste, but are there any other pressures on the oceans that are as worrying, or are these the ones that are the key ones that we should be looking at?
I think for me, what I've realised the most is that we need to stop looking at them as separate issues. And I think we so often forget just how connected these things are.
Yeah.
And that in our oceans especially, we think about our coastal waters, but we often neglect just how connected all of our waters are and how pollution from one area will impact another area. But then also just between those issues. So if you over-harvest from a reef, and then you also have ocean acidification, stony coral tissue disease, all interacting in that same ecosystem, they all contribute together. So actually, a coral reef that has less fish is going to be more vulnerable to coral bleaching because it is transitioning into this algal phase, because everything is becoming unbalanced. The entire ocean ecosystem is a delicate balancing act. So actually, a lot of these issues interact together to create a bigger problem. And often it's not a matter of just fixing one issue. We need to fix all of them in order for it to have enough of an impact. And that was one of the things that I went into in my film, was there was a whole sequence in Jamaica, and that was about the work they're doing to restore their reef, and how it wasn't a matter of just saying to the fishermen, no, you can't fish here anymore. It was about also replanting the corals to bring back the habitat for the fish to return after creating a no-take zone, providing new jobs for the fishermen that are being displaced, working with the local farmers to change their practices to ensure there wasn't runoff that was adding the wrong nutrients into these ecosystems, planting mangroves to create nurseries. And those are all different issues that were all coming together to create one solution.
So it's almost like a circle domino effect, with once one thing falls, the whole thing starts to.
Exactly.
We focused a lot there on corals, and this might be, like, you know, one of the most, you know, vital areas to protect. But what animals or environments have suffered the most? Is that coral reefs?
To be honest with you, I wouldn't be able to tell you which ones suffer the most. I think that there's a lot of research that takes place on coral reefs, so it's one of the most documented in terms of decline. But even just off the UK, the amount of seagrasses that we've lost, the decline of kelp forests of California is huge, and all of these ecosystems, and mangroves as well, in the Caribbean, we've decimated mangroves. And each of these different ecosystems are essential for different species. So there will be a lot, and also often they'll have one species, but they need each of these ecosystems for different life stages. So it's not a matter of kind of one just being more heavily impacted. Again, it's all very connected.
And I think it's very easy, especially in the modern world, for people to disconnect themselves, not only from nature, but especially from marine environments, because it's not somewhere we naturally are often. It's, you know, we don't go in the ocean as much as we walk through the park or a forest. So I think it's somewhere that people disconnect themselves and might sometimes be confused why it's important to protect or think about it. But why should people, or why is marine environments, why are they so important for the planet and our own lives?
It's a really funny one, because I agree with you that it is one that in the UK a lot of people do disconnect themselves from. And speaking to my friends, if you ask most of them if they've been swimming in the sea this year, most of them would say no. But actually, from a global perspective, we aggregate to our oceans.
Yeah.
And huge populations of people, we literally, if you look at the density of our populations, we cluster around the coastline, because we have this, we're innately drawn to water. And our oceans are so important for so many different reasons. Not only do they provide the oxygen that we breathe, our oceans are incredible when it comes to providing oxygen. They provide more oxygen than rainforests. Mm. Our kelp forests and our mangroves are one of our main suppliers of oxygen. So we literally cannot survive without life in our oceans. There's also the huge amounts of fish that they provide for people to eat, for the local economy. Tourism is absolutely huge, and our oceans provide those recreational spaces that billions of people are relying on.
And one thing I noticed in the write-up of your film, you said that the film is not about loss, it's about hope. And I really liked that line. So what is being done to help our oceans at the moment?
I think it's so important that hope is what we focus on, because, as a young person, I think it's so easy to be kind of drowned down by all of this fatigue about our climate and about the state of things. So I do think that hope is such an important narrative. Mm. And in this film specifically, it was about what generations are doing to move forwards. And I think that there are some that aren't new. One of the things that I talked about in the film was MPAs and how some of them have been established for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm. And it wasn't a matter of creating policy, it was a matter of tradition.
Yeah.
And when it came to policy being put in place, it was just going, oh, well, we already do that, we'll just make it into official paperwork. But there are communities, Yap and Palau are fantastic examples of that, where the chiefs and the elders have this fantastic knowledge of local fish, of spawning activities, of how to interact with their coastline and how to use the coastline, but in a way that is sustainable and is ethical. And they've done a brilliant job of that. So sometimes it isn't about finding new solutions, it's about understanding what's already there and what works, and taking the time to learn from others. So there's some really brilliant MPAs that serve as fantastic examples for that. But in addition to the places that are already incredibly damaged, there is some fantastic work taking place to rebuild them. And I think that when we look at a coastal conservation, it's important that we don't approach it with a blanket response. Mm. Because every community, every culture, every environment is unique. Yeah. And when something is unique, it needs unique solutions. It needs solutions that work for all the people, for the economics, for the culture, and for the environment. And that was what I really loved about the project in Jamaica, is that it was a community-driven grassroots conservation project that listened to the local people that work and live on their coastline and said, okay, well, here are the problems. What do we all want to do moving forwards? How can we make this a solution not only for the environment, but for the people that call this place home as well? And they've done a really fantastic job at not only rebuilding corals, but also implying alternative employment that was in keeping with what the people who utilised that coastline wanted. And they were able to maintain their own lifestyle, their way of living, their culture and tradition, and yet still create a more sustainable future.
And I think that's, and you will agree with me on this, one of the most important things, and something I don't know if I believe this, but I see it a lot, is in, you know, in the Western world, in Britain and in America and places like this, we forget to think about the people all the time. We focus on fix it, get rid of it, or stop doing that, and we forget, like you said, that blanket approach of just doing one thing everywhere, and we really forget to take on board how this affects, you know, not us, including everyone else that relies on the environment for whatever reason they do.
Yeah, I think if it's going to be successful, it has to be supported by everybody, and it has to be something that everyone can benefit from, not only creating those opportunities, but also making the ocean something that they feel is there for them as well. Mm. And if people have pride in their local environment and in their coastline, then they'll also want to protect it. And there's no reason for anyone to be someone that loses out. There are solutions that can work for everybody. It's just a matter of actually taking the time to listen and to learn.
How can marine films help with benefiting the environment?
I think what I love about documentary in that format is that it allows people to gain those connections to the ocean and reconnect with nature, which is so important. I think the more connected we feel with nature, the more we want to look after it, and the more we feel empowered to make personal decisions that are more sustainable. So I think film is a really fantastic tool for that. I think it's like the iconic Jacques Cousteau quote, which is that we protect what we love.
Yes.
And film allows us to learn what we love, and it gives those people that maybe don't have regular access to our oceans or to that world a little bit of insight into that world. And hopefully it will change their perspective enough that they will want to become ocean conservationists.
And before I move on to my last question, your short film, My 25, where is that available for people to watch?
It is currently playing at a few different screenings. It is at Woods Hole Film Festival right now.
Oh, wow.
I think that ends tomorrow, so that's probably not very helpful. It will be at the Brighton Rocks Film Festival through August, and it will be playing at Wild Screen, which is a big Bristol festival, which will also be digital this year due to coronavirus. And that will be starting in September, running into October.
Amazing.
And then it will be playing at the Wildlife Conservation Film Festival in September, October in Los Angeles and New York.
Incredible. And my last question to you, and this is, as my listeners know, a question that I ask all my guests, is if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone regarding the natural world, what would you pass on?
I think the most important thing is that you share your story and share your passion. Mm. I think every one of us has the opportunity to be an advocate for our natural environment, and that you have the opportunity to inspire others. And just your individual actions, your individual conversations that you have with your friends and your family, you would be shocked by how far that can go. So find what you're good at, find where you feel your talents lie, and think about how you can apply those to the natural world and how you can apply those to conservation, whether it's writing music about your favorite wild space or creating artwork that inspires the conservation movement. I think that's something that we can all do to contribute to fight for our oceans and for the wilderness, really.
Absolutely. Inca, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. And I truly hope that you can go back to wildlife filmmaking very soon, as soon as the world sorts itself out again. But it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
No worries. It was lovely.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Inca is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Inca Cresswell. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod on Twitter and Into the Wild Podcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you'd like to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, stay cool, and enjoy the good life.